government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence with Prince, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this December the 9th on the West Coast, now December the 10th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. It's nice to have you with us, and we also want to welcome those who are listening around the world on Wind Talkers Radio Network, many members in the U.S. military or former members. In Russia, Australia, New Zealand, Scotland, Ireland, all the way across Europe, actually, Central and South America, even in Hawaii. Welcome. And also those listening in on blogtalkradio.com. Nice to have you folks with us and glad you're carrying the show. Well, lots going on. In this world, in this crazy, crazy world, the spin meisters are at it, as usual. We have global warming, they're telling us, and I can tell you all the way across the Midwest, we have 50 to 60 mile an hour straight line winds and freezing temperatures. We've got snow, but thank God for global warming. We'd have ice cubes coming down, I guess. Tonight's guest is a frequent guest on Evident Footprints. He's got a absolutely rockin' website, rockin' and rollin'. It's called educate-yourself.org. If you're interested in things like, well, reptilians, flying saucers, chemtrails, swine flu, corrupt politicians, healing modalities, get well modalities, whatever you want to call them, he's got something on just about every topic you can imagine. And he's been out there for a number of years. He's one of the most popular websites, has one of the most popular websites in the whole world. And I'm privileged to call him my friend. And occasionally we work together on research. And when the minions come out, they come after both of us. My good friend, Ken Adachi. Ken, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Don. Always a pleasure to be on with you. And appreciate the opportunity to share this hour together.
Well, you've been a busy boy lately, haven't you? Especially when it comes to radio. You've been on a few shows. You were on True Ott's radio show, The Story Behind the Story, yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to talk about the mind control, Sorshafal, all the psyops that are going on out there. It's amazing that someone like an alleged Russian nun is sending emails out. She's got intelligence on the whole world.
Yes.
It's amazing the stories that come out. Of course, I'm laughing because it's absolutely ridiculous, and yet So many people fall for this stuff.
Yes.
And you had 2 hours of that. I don't know if you care to say anything more about it since you did the show with True yesterday.
Oh, we don't have to say much. Just a couple minutes of it. Essentially, Sorshafal is a, a dying psyops operation. I can't say for certain, but I do recall that when this operation began, this person, it's apparently not a single individual, at least based on what I'm new information that I'm hearing from True Ott.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly a psyops. But he obtained a lot more information about the background of this name than I was even aware of. Naturally, I took the name at face value. I didn't have superior knowledge at the time, but Dr. Truott has done some amazing digging, and he found that, in fact, the name is a sort of a Druidic name, and that there's been the use of this name goes back quite a number of years. In fact, he was telling me that there was even during World War II in the 1940s, there was a book published under the name Sorcha Fall. So there will always be a variety of people who read articles on the internet who go at, you know, anywhere from complete newbies to people who have been surfing the internet for a number of years, and probably, at least if they're into the alternative media websites, would probably have picked up by now that Sorcha Fall is a disinformation operation. I just would add that though there is a new effort now to create fear and anxiety concerning the year 2012. I just got a couple emails today from an individual who's, let's say, embracing a fundamentalist Christian / Zionist posture in his mailings. Why he put me on his list, I don't know, but at least I'm privy to what he's sending out to his list. And this fellow is trying to make the case that the 2012 is going to be the Armageddon date, and that Christ is going to return to earth, and all the signs are here, and he gives a lot of bulleted points to, quote, prove his case, et cetera, et cetera. Well, anyone who reads the page on my website called British Israel will know that this is a planned psyops that really was set into motion in the latter half of the 19th century. So this operation's got, you know, 150, 160 years of planning behind it. This is not something that the Illuminati just, you know, thought up post-World War II. And I would say the majority of people in the world who are Christian, who've been exposed to Bible preaching, exposed to various teachings, particularly if you're of the fundamentalist persuasion, Protestant fundamentalist persuasion, have heard this theme echoed again and again in preaching, and it's that the day of reckoning is coming. There's going to be this huge conflagration in the Middle East, Armageddon. It's supposed to be a pitched battle to the death, if you will, of Christians against Muslims, and there's going to be a lot of misery, death, and dying. And as we're supposedly in the darkest, blackest hour of all this terrible events, Christ is going to come down and onto earth and rule from a throne in Jerusalem. That's the story. It's a nice story, but it's just a story. Now, I don't mean to offend anyone who takes this as gospel. However, I've seen enough information, I've read enough information to convince me that it is a psyops. And as I mentioned, it was put into motion by the British Roundtable in the latter half of the 20th of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming towards fruition now of this operation. And so a great deal of anxiety will be generated over the internet concerning this great or prophesized events leading up to 2012. And my advice is don't be so quick to buy it. It's the old players behind the curtain trying to keep us in a state of anxiety, trying to keep us worried and hunkered down and, you know, build our underground shelters and save our seeds and, you know, and get ready for the really bad times and load up on lots of ammo and all that survivalist mindset that, you know, it's the only conclusion you come to. If you buy into the story that there's going to be, you know, 12 planets going to come through, it's going to cause massive Earth changes, and or there's going to be an Armageddon scenario in which just the whole world is going to be consumed by, you know, unbelievable war, nuclear exchange, the nuclear winter, you know, unbelievable famine, disease, death all over the place. If you're going to buy or an asteroid's going to hit the Earth, et cetera. If you're going to buy any of these doom and gloom scenarios, well, logic leads you to the only conclusion: in order to survive, you got to become isolated. You got to, you know, get together with your friends and form up a militia, and you know, get armed to the teeth and dig underground shelters and et cetera, et cetera. That's the only conclusion you can come to if you're going to buy the Armageddon stuff. And what I'm saying is that I don't buy a word of it. I don't buy a word of it.
Yeah. I'd like to make one comment about, you mentioned Sor Shafal, and, well, I did too. I think I brought up the whole topic. But Truat, I should say Dr. A. Truat, looked into the meaning of the name, and he basically described the letters of the name as sort of a word puzzle. And you could sort it out by changing letters around to spell out the words as of Rachel or Rachel. That's an alternative spelling for Rachel. Now they're speaking about Rachel in the Bible, and he mentioned Rebecca. He had been doing some research on that, and I mentioned to him that I had looked up David Booth's name in a people search engine, and the name that came at the top of the page, even though I typed in the word David, the name Rebecca came out. Rebecca Booth. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really interesting because they do use these databases for their satanic rituals and mm-hmm. and their inside codes, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, we could call it an inside joke for that matter. But mm-hmm. they put these things out there like that. And they're, you know, what does as of Rachel mean? I think it could be taken to mean according to Rachel.
Mm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So there's this nun that is telling us what's going on with the intelligence agencies around the world. Come on. Wake up, people. Really, wake up. Mm-hmm. it's ludicrous.
Yeah, like I said, I think overall the popularity or let's say belief in or credibility of Sor Shafal has, I believe, has sunken substantially from what it was, let's say, 4 years ago. And I might say the same of another doom and gloom prophet, if you will, out of Australia, a woman who called herself Amitak Stanford. I began to criticize and debunk her about the same time I was criticizing Sor Shafal. It seems to me I did that around 2005, 2006, and sporadically up to at least last year, I've posted a number of articles describing what I feel is the misleading and doom and gloom riddled psyops of Amitak Stanford, who I didn't know it when she first came out of the box on her own, which I'm thinking it's around 2005. I'd have to check the computer to be sure, but it sounds about right to me.
We're going to hold you to it, you know, on this show.
Yeah. No, 2005 sounds about right. Yeah. She, again, her popularity zoomed very quickly because what she had to say was pretty startling and compelling stuff. I'm quite sure she's in contact with the, let's say, alien beings. And she has a lot of heavy duty stuff that she has to say. However, with repeated, you know, with reading her articles and digesting them over time, my suspicion meter started to rise. And the first article I wrote about her was either late 2005, early 2006, and I titled it something along the lines, "I'm having increasing concerns about the veracity or the credibility of Amitakh Stanford." And prior to that, I wouldn't say I was a vigorous fan, but nevertheless, I thought it was okay stuff, and I was posting it. But as you read it, same with Sor Shafal, themes start to emerge, consistent themes, and then you start to realize, hey, wait a minute, am I being played? I've got to say the same for, you know, I took off the messages from Matthew from my website about two or three years ago, I'm not sure, somewhere in that space, because same field there. I initially felt very positive about the information, but as I continued to read it, I started to see PSYOPs, propaganda themes, or let's say propaganda themes, which the Illuminati are trying to promote, embedded within the words of this person. And I started to say, hey, wait a minute. And in that case, I really held off for a long time. I was posting that stuff for 2 or 3 years prior to saying, wait a minute, I got to stop putting this stuff up and just express my thoughts about it. And so it took me a long time there because I was very reluctant. I didn't want to offend the mother who's channeling the information. But when you read it, you just got to come to grips with reality. While the majority of it is very good material, it seems to be on the level, I keep on reading these Illuminati stuff layered in there. And I'm telling myself, wait a minute, I can't buy this. And I just, you know, my frustration got to the point I just essentially kind of blew my top, and I just decided I'm going to just talk about this and let this one hang out and take this stuff off my site and explain why I'm taking it off.
And it's sort of like Neil Donald Walsh having his conversations with God in Book 2 saying that George W. Bush is going to go down on record as one of the greatest presidents of all time.
Right, exactly. I mean, I've had people who also brought books like that to my attention when they first come out. They got a lot of attention on the internet. You know, a lot of recordings are sold. I think someone gave me audio tapes. And most of it sounds good. You know, most of it sounds legitimate. Most of it sounds like, let's say, acceptable metaphysical information. Inspiration, right? But they keep on layering in this Illuminati stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if you listen to it or read it off, you know, frequently enough, you know, your suspicion meter will start to rise. And that's exactly what's happened to me. So in the cases of the individuals we're talking about. So we just have to call it as we see it, you know. And
you might be right, you know, if you find out some of the things I'm finding out.
I know. So, you know, there was a very nice man who's had me on his mailing list for a long time, and he puts out a lot of really good stuff. He's a very sincere individual, but a few years ago in one of his mailings, he was promoting a book or making available a book that was supposedly written by someone who, and I can't even remember the name of the author, but the thesis of the book is they had well-known personalities, political personalities, in the book, which the book is claiming are now the reincarnated spirits of, you know, the most important founding fathers of the country. And this list, don't you know it, included people like President George W. Bush. I don't know whether he was assigned to be the, you know, the spirit of Thomas Jefferson or Benjamin Franklin, I can't remember, but whoever he was supposed to be the reincarnation from, it wasn't Benedict Arnold, I'll tell you that much, okay? And down the line, the other members of that treasonous cabinet of his were also named as reincarnations of other great American founding, you know, Thomas Paine and I just when I read this, you know, the description of this book and who they're talking about, and I just shake my head and I'm telling myself, what is this guy thinking of that he should send this out to people to actually encourage them to buy this book when it's such utter lunacy? And when I hear of other people who do conferences and claim to be the reincarnated spirit of Edgar Cayce and so forth, this also makes my suspicion meter go way up, because we are living in an age of deception if there ever was one.
Oh, yeah. You know, and I don't want to change subjects here. I want to embellish a little bit on what you just said.
Yeah.
Have you seen the pictures coming out of Norway of this blue and white spiral that's in the sky coming from a singular beam behind what appears to be a mountain? This is a night shot. And this thing spirals in a clockwise direction, forming a bright light at the center. And a picture, like a flashlight beam that has contained within it a spiral. And at the very center, the spiral is white. And then there is this ice blue spiral that comes out of it at an angle towards the light.
Mm-hmm.
And they're saying that residents in northern Norway saw this light show take place in the sky.
Yeah.
First of all, looking at it, it looks like an artist's rendition of two vortices that are at right angles to each other.
Mm-hmm.
Number one. Mm-hmm. And like they superimpose this over a night sky, and you don't even know that this is Norway from the picture. They just say it's from Norway.
Right. Right.
And I'll have to send this to you. But one of our listeners, David in the state of Washington, thank you, David, sent this. And he had an interesting message that I thought I would share here, because we do have people who are waking up. And mm-hmm. he said in the email to me, here's a curiosity. Grab a salt shaker, stand back, and have a discreet look at this preparation for the second coming a light show in the next sky event. And then, question mark, looks like Hollywood North, he says.
Mm-hmm.
So people are discerning what they're seeing right away.
Yeah, that's really nice to hear.
it's so ridiculous that they're doing this. Now, I think you had an opportunity, or maybe it wasn't you, maybe it was Dr. Mike Castle, to talk about this event that occurred last month in Utah, the meteorite, as the mainstream media reported it.
Yeah, we have talked about it somewhat in our last interview. We touched on it a bit. Did you want to embellish based on what you heard from?
Yeah. See, I discerned what that was immediately.
There
was a picture that came out that had a spiral in the sky.
Mm-hmm. That's right. It looked almost like a cloud, a spiral.
Yeah, a series of circles.
Okay. Right.
There was sort of this serpentine shape, like a rocket that had gone awry or something.
Right.
Flying more horizontally than it was vertically. Mm-hmm. And then there was this circle, and when people woke up in the morning and the sun had not yet risen, this circle was glowing.
Right.
I knew that it was. I just knew that it was a craft that had been shot down.
Right.
There's been a lot of stuff. I reported something on the show on August 25th.
Mm-hmm.
That was confirmed. People all over the state of Ohio witnessed scrambling jets that had anti-gravity technology.
Right.
That you could see from the ground, because the whole plane lights up when they turn it on.
Right.
And they were reporting it on WTAM 1100 AM radio. So I'm not making this up. There's an archive of this, you know.
Right.
And I was taking a friend to the airport, and all on the way there, It began, basically, it began like 3 p.m. East Coast time. And by 5:30, I had counted some 68 craft, and they all appeared to be coming out of Lake Erie. And when I say out of Lake Erie, I don't mean out of the Lake Erie area. I mean out of Lake
Erie. Out of Lake Erie.
Okay. All right. They weren't dripping water or anything like that, because that anti-gravity technology forces the water away, you see.
Right.
And much like you can dive through the water, you're not soaking up all the water you're swimming in. You're pushing it to the side.
Right.
It's just that you feel the sensation of getting wet. But it's a different phenomenon with an airplane touching water or a flying saucer moving through water. And because of that, they do have bases underground. Now, we even had a caller a couple of weeks ago, Rodney in South Carolina, called in and talked about his knowledge of an underground base. I should say under lake base in Lake Erie. So we witnessed an event that was a galactic event that was occurring in space above Ohio and Toronto, Ontario, Canada. We knew that there was something going on. The jets began scrambling and chemtrailing the sky like you've never seen before. Their goal was to obfuscate whatever was happening up in the sky. Even after they did it, I could see what was happening, but I was seeing it in the spirit, see? I was seeing what was happening, and it was verified. Now, when I heard about this event, that was immediately explained away as a meteorite. Now, what does the media know about meteorites? But right away, they have the answer. You know, it's a meteorite. Oh, yeah, it's fireballs coming down. Yes, and there's danger because people are going to get hit with it. And they're even saying what the force, NASA saying what the force of this meteorite is. And they know darn well that it wasn't a meteorite, that it was an alien ship, and it had an anti-gravity system in it, and it had antimatter. So you're seeing the results of that antimatter device just being totally obliterated over eastern Utah. And this was a reptilian craft, and the craft is a group. There is a group of reptilians from Sirius and from the Pleiades. Now, people think when they hear the Pleiades that there's these seven stars out there, so there's like one or two planets. There are thousands of planets up there. And there are reptilians in all kinds of star systems. They're here, for crying out loud. Okay? And they're elsewhere. So it's as simple as that. But they have to come out and dumb down the public right away. And you'll see these pictures go up, and they encourage people to give comments. And you get the operatives there, all the people engaging in the brainwashing and the mind control, you know. Ridiculing anybody that would suggest
it. Who actually comes out with the truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. That's the standard operating procedure.
Yeah, and because somebody's not ready to accept it doesn't negate it, doesn't nullify it.
Right, of course.
Doesn't disqualify it.
Right.
As factual or evidential.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I just wanted to make that point because all of these, you know, there are things that are going on that are much, much more difficult to wrap your mind around, and yet they're real.
Right.
And
right.
These simple things of causing people to believe that there's someone in Russia that actually gives a damn about the people in the United States. I don't say that to insult the Russian listeners we have, but that this nun who devotes her life to what religion is it? You know, is meddling in political affairs of all the intelligence agencies of the world? Stop and think. What's going on? You know?
Well, we'll just I'll complete the thought here about Sorcha Fowl. When this individual originally came out, as I mentioned to you last time, I the nun part is news to me. That the woman originally, or the cover story is she was this sort of youngish woman in her late 20s, early 30s, judging from her picture. They used to publish a picture of her quite often, so it was a brunette, and she looked, you know, like a very nice-looking young woman, and there was no mention of a nun at that time. But it's definitely a psyops, and I hope enough people will, you know, not invest a lot of time and energy in reading the stories, because they're mostly doom and gloom,
mm-hmm.
the sky is falling type of anxiety producers. That's the goal of doom and gloomers, is to get you really shook up.
Yeah.
If I could, Don, I'd like to spend a little bit of, or let's say the balance of this show here, to get into an area which I've been hoping to touch on for many shows, but typically we never have enough time because these other subjects we talk about bring us into many different branches of discussion, and I never get around to it. But if I could, I'd like to at least devote the second half of this show to just talking about some very simple techniques which people can learn to do themselves to take care of their health.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I'm sort of bringing it up now is that being in the dead of winter, you know, in December, at least in the northern hemisphere, and because they've been, you know, pumping or creating the swine flu pandemic for the last 2.5 months, this is certainly the time if people are going to get a cold or a flu, whether it's, you know, the the made-up variety or genuine flu or et cetera, this is usually the time it happens between now and, you know, January, February, et cetera. I hope, I believe, I have the feeling, I'm getting the impression that the swine flu, the hysteria to get a swine flu poison vaccine is diminishing rapidly. And I think the majority of the population now, if they haven't gotten the flu yet, if they haven't gotten the vaccine yet, probably are not going to get it. I think there's been enough information put out by alternative health website, you know, writers and people like Dr. Truat or Len Horowitz or any of the other folks who've been putting up videos trying to, or Gary Null, I got to give him credit right at the top of the line. I think enough of the population is beginning to see that A, there was no swine flu pandemic, and
it's a scamdemic is what it is.
Pandemic?
No, I'm saying scamdemic.
Scandemic. very good. And there, you know, that the vaccine is more of a danger. It can cause far more problems than if you were to get the flu. So I think enough people are, the campaign is winding down. However, I might say there was just there was an article in the newspaper about 5 or 6 days ago here in California, in which the California state legislature, in an obvious payoff to political contributors, spent or assigned $7 million taxpayer dollars to half a dozen public relations firms to help us dummies here in California realize just how serious the swine flu pandemic is and how beneficial and necessary it is to get our swine flu vaccine. Because there's been so many of these conspiracy nut lunatics on the internet who apparently have had far more success than imagined to talk people out of getting the vaccine. And don't you know we have to spend $7 million of taxpayer money to have political payees bombard us with another couple months of propaganda, because I guess we're just not getting the swine flu fast enough here in California. So we need an additional dose of propaganda, you know, a full-time effort on TV, on AM and FM radio, on every mainline website. Apparently it's not enough. We have to use more of our money to pay public relations propagandists to stuff the message down our throat even more. I don't think it will have any effect. I think they'll just squander $7 million of taxpayer dollars on you know, people who've greased the palms of politicians. But it shows you that they're not giving up on this easily. However, I think the public, at least the majority of the public, I believe now, has caught on to the insanity of taking this vaccine. And now, thanks to, well, I should say, unfortunately, due to the death and the dramatic crippling of many people, which whose story winds up on the internet, such as the Desiree Jennings story, that people are now beginning to realize that there's not only a problem with the laboratory-created swine flu vaccine, but there's a problem with all vaccines, and that now the message that the alternative health world has been trumpeting for decades is that all vaccines are a mistake. There are no, let me repeat, zero, nada, none, no vaccines that have any value to you versus the damage they do to your body as a result of getting vaccine.
I didn't know you spoke Spanish.
Pardon?
I didn't know you spoke Spanish.
I did. I do. poorly, but
no.
I do. And
yes, yeah, this is true. What you're saying is very true.
Okay, so I'll stop with this diatribe, but it's necessary for folks to realize that all vaccines are damaging to the body. And I'm going to there's a couple articles I just was sent to me. I'm going to put up today, which is titled "Avoid All Vaccinations." There's plenty of good information on the internet. There's a lot of articles on my website. Now I have a special page devoted to swine flu hoax and the dangers of the swine vaccine. There's, I don't know, there might be 50 or 60 or 70 articles on there now. I link to some splendid articles, or well-written reports, I should say, by Gary Null and his associates. But there are many others. Tim O'Shea, Dr. Tim O'Shea, has put out a number of books explaining the dangers of vaccinations, all vaccines. I'm trying to remember this fellow named Neil Miller, who had some books out 10 or 12 or 13 years ago. Dr. Vera Scheibner out of Australia has wonderful books and DVDs, goes into great detail. Dr. Braylock, Dr. Mercola, Joseph Mercola's website, tons of good material. Dr. David Molden. There is a large number currently living in individuals who've done yeoman's work in trying to warn the public of the dangers of all vaccines. So,
you know, there's a very simple point I'd like to make before you go into this, and I think it'd be good for the listeners to consider this while they're listening to you speak.
Okay.
We're recommended to eat certain types of food, and we know for a variety of reasons that many people are allergic to certain kinds of food. Many people can't digest milk. They have digestive problems when they drink milk. Some get very sick, have mm-hmm. to go to the hospital, or you know, get medical treatment. I don't necessarily even recommend anymore that anyone go to the hospital if they can avoid it. But some people eat meat. Some people are vegetarians. Some people just eat fruit and nuts and grains, and they stay away from everything else. How is it that they can make this fluid that everybody is supposed to take and it's going to have the same impact on everybody? Impossible. It's going to have a different result in every single person that gets one. And I'm speaking about vaccines, of course.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's something to consider, that what one person might not be affected by could kill you.
Yeah, thank you, Don. That's a really good point. We need to, let's just take a minute or two just to emphasize the point you just made. a large percentage of people who get vaccines do not suffer any apparent adverse effects at that moment or even in the weeks to follow it. So many people assume, well, there's nothing wrong with the vaccine. It didn't bother me. In fact, when I come into these websites that attempt to essentially sell the pro-vaccine story, and you have these commenters who, you know, write in and add their message to the list, very often you'll hear that sort of sentiment. Well, I took it. I had no problem whatsoever. I'm glad I did. I don't want that swine flu. Heck, you can die from that. You know, that type of response.
Arch.
And what you don't know is that everyone has a different immune system, and we also have different tolerance levels to various substances.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There's a large variety of toxic substances in vaccines. And even though you might not have an immediate allergic, hyper-allergic reaction, anaphylactic reaction it's called, in which, let's say, you have trouble breathing or your heart stops, you know, I mean, a real serious one. Even if you don't have that, a lot of people will get some sort of soreness in their arm, and a lot of people will be in the gray area, in which they will get sort of flu-like symptoms for a week or two and so forth. But for those who feel absolutely nothing, it doesn't mean that, there's zero problem for you. It just means that your body did not have an allergic reaction at that moment. But you might have a reaction years down the line. Now, Atruat has made the point in his discussion about the whole conspiracy behind, you know, the hidden conspiracy behind vaccines, is that vaccines have a hidden agenda to create disease,
mm-hmm.
to create sterility, to create cancer. Now, why would they want to do that? Because these are the folks that provide the drugs that treat the disease, see? That's why they do it. Because they're amoral.
Autism is another one.
Right, exactly.
It's
right.
This one.
Right. So that's the message. You know, as far as I'm concerned, of course, don't take the swine flu vaccine. It's a bioweaponized, patented, toxic cocktail. Why would you put that in your body? That's insane. I mean, would you breathe depleted uranium dust? Come on, let's wake up.
Well,
but beyond that,
now. whether we like it or not.
Whether you like it or not, yeah.
It's sort of tongue-in-cheek, but it's there's a truth to it, too.
Right.
You know, we're breathing in all kinds of toxins. And I just wanted to make that distinction, you know, that you know, we listen to this and we don't pay attention to how we react differently to food. How is it that they can come up with something that is going to heal everyone? When they can't heal diseases, they've proven that their intention is not to heal cancer.
Right, right.
When
exactly.
It comes up with a cure for cancer, like Dr. Mm-hmm. De Clark, for example,
mm-hmm.
and I did say that word cure because she was curing cancer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or showing people how they could cure themselves.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. So let's launch into this area for the remaining time that we have, and
sure.
Maybe I could pick it up in the next talk. But let me begin with, there are plenty of excellent books on taking care of your own health. There's thousands of them. I have a substantial library myself. I mean, our place here is just bulging with bookshelves in every room. And if I had, you know, a bigger house, I'd probably have more bookshelves and more books. So I'm going to recommend folks to obtain the books of Huldah Clark for a couple of reasons. Is that she just passed away this year at 83 years old. I think. She was a wonderful person in my opinion, but she was an extraordinary researcher, and she, working with her son, developed a simple electronic device that she called a synchrometer. And she explains to people in her books, in all of her books, how you can make your own synchrometer. It takes a few months of practice to learn how to use this device competently. You can make one yourself. You can buy one from vendors. There's plenty of people on the internet who make them available as a ready-made unit. But the skill, it does take a number of months of training. Huldah Clark recommended 2 hours of practice a day for about 6 months to become competent in the use of this device. Some people with better ears, for instance, musicians who have a more finely tuned ear, will succeed sooner because the process involves listening to a series of tones. And when you have one series of tones, it tells you this is a negative reaction. And when you get a slightly different second series of tones, this is the indicator that it's a positive reaction. And what you're doing with the synchrometer is you're testing for the presence of substances in the body. I mean, you're normally, the purpose of the testing is to test the human body, but you can test an animal's body, you can find the presence of any substance in creation, any molecule, any element, any compound. If you have a sample of that compound or molecule or pathogen, it could be a virus, bacteria, fungus, mold, parasite, etc. If you had that organism, let's say mounted on a slide, the synchrometer compares the frequency of the object you're searching for in the body. Let's use an example. Let's just say a tapeworm, just to come up with a large parasite. If you had tapeworm segment mounted on a slide, if you were to put that on one plate of the synchrometer, and then let's say you were to put, you can put yourself in the circuit, or you can have another individual sitting next to you and have them hold electrodes. They can put themselves in the circuit, or you can use a sample of their DNA. Their saliva, for instance, it makes a good sample. And you could put it, some of their saliva mixed with a small piece of white paper towel placed inside a zipper lock bag. And that can serve as the representative of the person. We usually call that the witness, okay? You can put that on the other plate. And by following the procedure of how to use the synchrometer, you can first test whether this person has that tapeworm or that species of tapeworm in their body by following the instructions on how to run a test with the synchrometer.
Mm-hmm.
And if the person doesn't have the tapeworm in their body, you'll get a negative response. And if the person has the tapeworm, you'll get a positive. This is why. The synchrometer is based on a very simple principle of physics called sympathetic resonant frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
The tapeworm, or even the dead body of the tapeworm, is still vibrating at a certain frequency. And in fact, it's not just one frequency, but it's within a range, or what we call a band of frequencies. But let's make it simple. Let's say it's vibrating in a band that's maybe 5 kilohertz wide, 5,000 cycles from highest frequency to lowest frequency. And I have no idea off the top of my head what is the resonant frequency of a tapeworm. So I'm just going to make a number up, okay? This isn't the actual
number.
Well,
I think it would probably vary with the size and even the type.
Yeah. No. It might vary slightly with the species. No, the size is immaterial. If you're dealing with a particular species, you know, genus and species, of a particular tapeworm, it doesn't matter how large the sample is. It could be microscopic and be the full tapeworm. You'll still get the same frequency response.
Next.
Anyway, what's happening is that the device is measuring the frequency of the substance you want to search for, and then it's hunting for that same frequency in your body. If the tapeworm's in your body, the frequency is being emitted by the tapeworm in your body. And when the two match, that creates a special sequence of tones that you would detect as a positive response. If there is no match there, then you'll get the sequence of tones that indicates a negative response. She used the synchrometer for many years. I'm not sure when she developed it exactly, but I have the feeling it was in the late 80s or very early 90s. And until her passing in the year 2009, she used this marvelous instrument daily as her primary detecting method of finding out what's going on in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have cancer in your body, cancer produces certain marker chemicals. If you have no cancer cells active in your body, you won't have these marker chemicals. Well, if I have a vial of this particular chemical on one plate of the synchrometer, and then I'm testing a subject on the second plate, even the saliva of the subject will suffice. If I get a positive response, that person has cancer growing somewhere in their body, because you only get cancer, you'll only get this particular chemical produced when you have cancer being processed. Now, there are a number of markers. There's not just one for cancer. There's a number of them, but I'm just using this one example that, you know, she talks about.
I have a question. Did she have a means of adjusting the amplitude of the particular frequency?
Yes, right. The device detection part is reduced down to an audio circuit, and yes, there is a volume control, so you can control the volume. You're listening through it to a speaker that's inside the device. You could plug in headphones if you want. You can do it either way, but the speaker works fine. And yes, there is an amplitude control on it. It's a very small, at the final stage of the synchrometer, there's a small audio amp there.
Mm-hmm.
And you can vary the output, so you can turn it up high enough so you can hear it to satisfy you. It doesn't have to be that high. When you're used to using it, the volume can be rather low because your ear will focus in and key in to this these tones. There's a series of set tones that indicate positive and another series of very set tones that indicate a negative. And once you get used to it and can consistently apply the probe correctly, there's part of the technique is that you have to press a probe against a portion of your skin, usually on your knuckles or on the side of your fingers. All this is explained very well in the videos that Huldah Clark's people have available on learning how to use the synchrometer. She also has a training manual called the Synchrometer Manual that explains the technique in great detail. It also gives you hundreds of experiments to run to hone your skill in using it, so that when you've practiced for, you know, it can take anywhere from 3 to 6 months, when you're skilled at it, you can be sure that your information will be accurate every single time.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite amazing, the simplicity yet the usefulness of this device. So people who learn to follow Huldah Clark's procedure acquire a large set of samples. Now, in many cases, you can make a sample set yourself. She explains this in the book. For instance, if you want to check if a certain organism is residing in your liver, you would put a slide, let's say, of the organism or the bacteria or the virus or whatever you're hunting for, plus on one plate, plus a slide of liver tissue on the same plate. When you do that, what happens is that the energy of the testing, instead of looking at the whole body, narrows its search down to just the liver. So it's looking for that particular pathogen in your liver. However, you don't have to have human liver tissue on the slide. It could be the liver of any animal, and it will still work equally well for human test subjects. So she explains how you can go to the supermarket and get a fish, you know? And you could dissect the fish and get parts of various organs and put them in very small vials with a little bit of water and a little bit of alcohol to preserve them. And then when you mark it, you know, if it's a fish liver, whatever it is, you mark it. And then when you want to do this testing and you need a liver sample, this will suffice fine. Of course, it could be any animals. I'm just suggesting.
Could be chicken livers.
Could be chicken. It could be any animal. So for instance, when you buy chicken, you know, they sell the internals parts part of the deal.
The gizzards and all.
The gizzards, right. People, you know, the kidneys and the brains and all. It's all there. So you can, she explains all this in the book. She tells you, she gives you a lot of ways to make up your own sample kit so you don't have to spend a lot of money. You can pretty, if you devote the time to it, you can pretty much do this on a shoestring budget. Now, there are some things which
I can see people trying this. Well, Mrs. Johnson, I think your problem is you've got a bad gizzard here. At least that's this chicken gizzard.
Well,
this
is the point, though.
Yeah.
Any tissue from any animal will work.
Yes.
So that makes it a lot easier. So you don't have to worry about getting human slides of human brain tissue. No. Any tissue from any animal will work equally well. So the reason I began this, the beginning this discussion about these various modalities and how to take care of yourself at home is to first explain the value of her books. If you could afford it, I would get all of her books.
Mm-hmm.
They're $22-$23 each from the publisher. If you're limited on money, then get the very latest one, which is the book that came out in 2007. And as you can afford them, work your way backwards. That's not to say that the earlier books aren't of great value. They are. All of her books are of value. There's different information in all of her books. That's why I'm suggesting getting all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a cornucopia of incredible research discoveries that she has achieved with her brains, her considerable academic training and background. She had a very well-rounded background, PhD. I mean, this lady really had a superb background in chemistry and biology. She really knows her stuff. Mm-hmm. She really knew her stuff. And she put her amazing intellectual skills to work with her drive to help humanity. And you know, really had made a wonderful contribution to all. And she gives you all this information in her books. She doesn't copyright. She doesn't patent. She could have made a fortune with her discoveries if she wanted to hoard the information and patent devices like the synchrometer, for instance. And just, you know, kept the money for her and her family and her estate and et cetera. She could have done very nicely. She didn't do that. She gave her best secrets away in her book.
Mm-hmm.
If she discovered something truly spectacular, she did not keep it to herself. She gave it away in her books.
Yeah. Now, what you're describing with the synchrometer, no pun intended, resonates with me. About 21 years ago, I was inspired to start cataloging the various frequencies of disease and the remedial frequencies to reverse that process. And I'm talking about very specific tones. You know, you could use a tone generator and emit sine waves or sawtooth waves, square waves, or combinations of those waves mm-hmm. with a frequency generator, and then measure the response of an individual. And I did this experiment with plants. You could actually affect the way the plants stood in their pots or outside. I even tested this outside where I'd take loudspeakers out near the garden and play certain types of music or certain types of sound and got very much into that. Now, I know that that same technology is in that device. In other words, the principles are in there. But mm-hmm. she's allowing the body to do its thing, and it's responding to what the technology can do.
Yes.
Basically the same principle.
Although yes.
Mine was more focused on music,
mm-hmm.
If you get my meaning.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I would write the music. And what's interesting, you're talking about something that's very, it's a parallel, where you say a person that gets this device and practices with it sort of gets a feel for how to use it, and they attune their ear. It's really not their physical ear that they're tuning in. You know, it's on a higher level that's actually occurring, on a metaphysical level.
Mm-hmm.
They just hear the sound and they know they can identify with it. You see,
mm-hmm.
Now with the music, it's sort of the same thing. What I experienced was the music was coming to me as the finished product, let's say, and I had to produce it. I had to literally transcribe it or reproduce it from my understanding of what that vibration felt like. You know, it would be like someone telling you a story about something that happened, and it spawned some creativity in you, and you came up with a different story, but it had the same vibrations, the same frequencies in it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you can do that with music because you're using musical instruments and things that make sounds. They can center on frequencies.
Yes. That's a very important point. We when we're younger, we're led to believe that it's substances let's say a medicine, for instance,
mm-hmm.
is what's curing us of a problem. Well, everything boils down to a vibration and energy. And what we can do is people, for instance, who can see auras,
mm-hmm.
or if you have an aura photography machine that can capture an aura on a Polaroid film, you can, visually see the human aura. People who are adept at reading the aura knows that certain colors mean certain things, and that if your color is dark in a certain area, or it's not of the right color, or it's diminished, that they know there's a problem in that area. There might be a cancer in that area. There might be a injured muscle or an injured joint or something. So when you add a substance that has a certain frequency, let's say a herb, that addresses that problem, if you were to examine the aura after the person's taken the herb, for instance, you notice the aura, the color is better. It's closer to where it should be, and perhaps the darkness now has reduced, and it has more of the characteristic light that era should have. Why?
Mm-hmm.
The herb contained frequencies. It was vibrating at frequencies that your body needed.
Yeah.
And once you fill in that, let's call it the missing frequency or the diminished frequency, when you add to it, it enhances the aura so that what's going on in the aura is what's happening in the body, okay? The disease essentially starts in the aura fields, and then it gradually translates from a higher dimension into the third dimension, and then it shows up as a cancer, for instance. But it starts in the aura. So if you could stimulate the aura with light frequencies, with sound frequencies,
mm-hmm.
with electromagnetic frequencies, with only magnetic frequencies, if you can stimulate or add that missing vibration that is needed, the aura will absorb it, you'll come up, and the body will start to heal. So the analogy you're making is the right one. Now, you talked about the use of frequency generators. When we get to the part of our presentation which we'll talk about the application of frequency therapy, we're going to go into, I will go into detail how you can use a frequency generator, and we'll talk about the virtues of various ways of transducing the energy. It could be a physical contact with the energy. It could be an oral contact. It could be a light contact with, or it could be an electromagnetic contact. There's a lot of ways to translate the energy. So we won't have enough time in tonight's show to get into it, but we'll definitely cover it in great detail when we get to, you know, frequency therapy, because that is one of the four major areas I was going to cover on how you can take care of your health at home, how you can address any illness, any disease, any problem at home yourself. You know, the only exception is, once again, I'll just remind you, we said this last time, but the only exception is severe acute trauma, heart attack, bleeding to death, you know, from an auto accident, you know. Of course you need an emergency room for those things. But for disease conditions, particularly chronic conditions, you can treat yourself at home, and there's nothing to fear. There's nothing to fear from no matter what bioweaponized, killer, patented weapon our treasonous friends have assembled in their labs at Fort Detrick, or in the lab in the Ukraine, or the ones in Germany, or wherever they've got their secret bio-killer labs. Certain principles of nature are at work regardless of how virulently they produce these bugs. And once you understand how those principles of nature work, you can counter, neutralize, and eradicate any bug they throw at you. It's really important that everyone who hears my words come to know that, because the bulk of humanity is unaware of that, and they are petrified with fear produced by the mainstream media when they're told there's this flu pandemic, and in order to save yourself and your kids and your pregnant wife, you've got to get a vaccine with this wonderful swine flu vaccine that they developed in order to actually kill you.
Yeah, isn't it a shame how corrupt things have become? That they have to actually impose this upon people as if this is the reality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's as though it's a reality created by the imposition, not mm-hmm. the fact that it's there.
Exactly.
You know, if they're manufacturing this whole thing.
Exactly. And they've been manufacturing it, and thank God that we're now at a time in man's history in which large bodies of people are beginning to realize this, and large numbers have already realized it, and they know the game. And it seems the reason they're ramping up all of their operations, you know, the swine flu nonsense, the vaccination, the Copenhagen thing, the health bill, all their games to try to get people knuckle under, to get your, you know, your Nazi ID card, get your DNA, to get you totally microchipped and trackable, et cetera, because they know that as each month passes along, more and more thousands of people find out about the New World Order takeover game. And they essentially, their goal is to kill off people faster than those numbers can come to realize just how thoroughly we've been betrayed by our so-called leaders.
Yeah. Boy, is that ever the case.
Yeah.
Now, you were talking about Hulda Clark's reference to the sample that you're testing or you're reading, and she called that a witness, right?
No, the sample from the persons whose body you want to test for substances in is, well, in my nomenclature, I call the sample of the party who you're looking for the information for. If you had the person, let's say you want to, you know, test your child for something, you can set up the synchronometer so that the child can hold an electrode in his hand, and now his body's in the circuit. But if the child isn't with you, if you have the child's saliva in a plastic bag with a little bit of water and a little piece of paper towel, and just put that bag, a plastic bag, on one of the plates in the synchronometer, it'll serve the same purpose as if the boy was actually sitting there and was in the circuit. That's what I'm calling the witness.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling the other thing test samples.
Okay, so when you're starting that test, do you say, "Can I get a witness?"
Oh, man, I knew you would pull off something like that. Very good. Very good. There had to be music in here somewhere. You took all that time to set
and I get a witness. You went through the explanation. I asked a pretty quick question. You're correcting me.
All right. I'm playing it straight here. Can I have a witness?
I thought of that immediately the first time you said it, but I
just, it out. Okay, that's wonderful.
I held it in it. I held it at bay as long as I could.
I liked it. Laugh.
Somebody out there is laughing. If not with us, at us, right?
Yes, our little piddly efforts at amusement here. So yeah. So the synchrometer is a wonderful tool, and as a result, she was able to, over many years of testing, delve deeper and deeper and deeper into the mysteries of the body. And this work allowed her to produce her books that essentially unravels the great secret and mystery of what causes cancer. I mean, when you talk to the conventional cancer world, if you were to go to your oncologist and say, "Doctor, what causes cancer?" First thing I would say, "Well, we don't really know, but we think," and then the yada, yada, yada. I remember 35 or 40 years ago, I had a cousin who was in the pharmaceutical industry, and we got into this discussion very seriously one night because, you know, I was sort of studying science myself at the time, and I was going to have this really, you know, investigative thing, and he was completely sincere in talking about it, but they were convinced it was a virus and so forth and so on. But if you really want to know what causes cancer, any cancer, to take hold in the body, read the last two books of Hulda Clark, the one that she produced in 2007 and 2004 and 2005. The name of the book in 2004 is The Prevention of All Cancers, and the book in 2007 is called The Cure and Prevention of and Prevention of All Cancers. And she will tell you, the books are about 500 pages long each. She will tell you in great detail, particularly in the 2007 book, which has her latest, most up-to-date discoveries, exactly why cancer starts. Cancer is a process which needs elements fed into it in order for it to survive. So you can think of these elements as, let's say, feeder pipes that feed into a main, let's say, trunk, okay? Let's use water pipe analogy just to make it simple, okay?
Or cap.
And at the end of the main trunk pipe, you know, the larger pipe, mm-hmm. is the cancer tumor. And it needs certain things fed to it. Otherwise, you cut off its supply, the tumor dies. Well, Hulda learned that there's valves, as it were, along the system. And if you can deny the cancering process one of its absolutely essential ingredients to allow it to thrive and live and grow by turning off its valve, then you effectively dry up the feeder line, and the cancer tumor cannot continue to grow. Mm-hmm. It withers and in time dies. And a lot of alternative cancer researchers in the 20th century discovered how to turn off cancer's growth. One of the best examples is Dr. Raymond Rife,
mm-hmm.
in the 20s and 30s, discovered how to apply certain frequencies that would match the oscillation rate of the cancerous bacteria viruses that always accompany a cancer. When you have cancer in your body, certain resident bacteria that are normally found in your body and are not necessarily harmful to you can change. They change into a new variety, a more deadly variety of bacteria and virus. And Raymond Rife identified those that he found in all cases of cancer as bacteria X and bacteria Y. And what he did is that he found that if he tuned his frequency equipment to a certain frequency that would match the natural oscillation frequency of that bacteria, he could vibrate the bacteria to death. It could be any sort of pathogenic organism, not just bacteria. It could be as small as a virus, but it could be as large as a parasite. It could be a colony of bacteria, funguses. It could be moles. And if you match the vibratory frequency of that substance, you could destroy it. And that's exactly what frequency therapy does. I mean,
mm-hmm.
because of Rife work, they call it Rife therapy, but I prefer to use the word frequency therapy because it's describing more on a mechanical level what's causing the organisms to succumb.
Yeah. See, now, with me writing music, and I know there are other people that have considered this or are doing it to some extent, maybe they're doing it more for meditation or relaxation, but I'm interested in focusing on these specific frequencies of the variety of maladies that people suffer, mm-hmm. in relation to the light body, because the sound can affect the light body, as you pointed
mm-hmm.
out,
mm-hmm.
and physically affect the body in the same way. So those frequencies are difficult to listen to. It's rather tiresome to listen to a frequency at a sound level where, you know, let's say a nominal amplitude, okay, mm-hmm. that will be effective. Mm-hmm. And so I discovered ways. I discovered the frequencies and then the actual combination of the waves. What better mm-hmm. way can you blend those to make them more tolerable,
right,
to the ear than through music?
Right.
And I'm not discounting what you can do with these frequency generators.
Mm-hmm.
But to sit there and listen, I don't know if you've ever been in an MRI machine that's using the Tesla coils and you hear this clicking sound as this, mm-hmm. okay? After 45 minutes, that's more than a pain in the neck.
Okay.
It's a traumatic experience for some people.
Mm.
And as sensitive as my ears are, I have to totally mentally block the sound out. That's the only way I can endure such a procedure, which I had to do a couple of times. when they were first coming out with this.
Okay.
And it was in relation to a physical injury that no doctor could spot. So they said, well, we have this device, it's a magnetic resonance imaging machine. And they couldn't find anything the first time. They couldn't find anything the second time. And then one day I get this call. Hey, we got a new software, and we're picking up really good images. I had already started writing this music, you see, at that point. I said, this is not the approach. For identifying something, maybe, yes. But see, we have the ability as spiritual beings to even sense these frequencies on our own. And you pointed that out. You know, it's the recognition of what the sounds do.
Yeah.
She can describe the procedure, but that person is going to develop their own style.
Mm-hmm.
And they should be able to. They're an individual. They're unlike anyone else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, this concept that we're all coming out of muffin pans is ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know? Or cookie sheets.
Mm-hmm.
You know? That's really how they treat us.
Right.
You know? So, well, did you say as much as you wanted to say on this show, Ken? Because we're about
we can leave it there. I at least got to introduce the subject, and I would like to perhaps, you know, we'll pick it up with our next one, and we might have to run this out even over two or three shows. I really don't know, but I would like to have this audio overview of how to attend to these treatment modalities yourself at home. So as people learn to first read the books, it's by the way, for people who can't read English, a number of her books, not all of them, but a number of her books are written in other languages. So German, French, Spanish, Dutch, Italian, Japanese. There's quite a variety. So if one were to you can go to the link, you can find Huldah Clark's publisher. I linked to them on the page I have devoted describing her books on my website. You know, at the top of every page on my website, there's rows of links. And somewhere in the middle there, you'll see Dr. Huldah Clark books. When you click it on, it'll give you a link to the publisher. And once you get to the publisher, you can start looking for the books in other languages. There's quite a few of them. Particularly her most popular books are the ones she came out in the 90s, The Cure for All Disease, for instance. I'm guessing, but I think it's published in at least 17 or 18 different languages. So, and now, because we have this translation technology that's available free from Google, etc., even if people have the book in English and they can't understand English, they could scan the pages and then run it through one of these translation programs. Granted, slightly laborious, but it's a way to get a fairly quick translation of the page without having to, you know, hire a translator to.
Do you think Congress will start making use of such a device?
Oh, no.
English translation?
Sure, quite sure Western medicine won't even recognize the significance of this device till, you know, easily 100 years from now.
Yeah.
It's so simple. I'll close out with this.
No,
talk.
I'm speaking about the translator on the Google.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Take a law and put that in it from English and translate it and then read it in English. You know?
I hear you.
Yeah, it's you know, we've had a couple of calls tonight, and I know that we've been trying to get this out
right
there.
Mm-hmm.
And Rodney from South Carolina called, and I sort of let him know that we were going to try to fit this in tonight. And now we've got Gary from Arkansas on the line.
Okay,
you want to take a call, Rodney, if you're still listening, Rodney, you can call in, and we'll take a question from both of you gentlemen.
Okay.
Is that fair?
Okay.
I hate to do this to these guys. So Gary,
okay, fine.
Gary from Arkansas, you're on with Ken Adachi. Question, please.
Well, I not so much a question, but some information I'd like to offer to add to the discussion. I read that book by Horowitz. I think it was AIDS and Ebola. Since you're a musician, you might know about this. He went into the Solfeggio tones.
Solfeggio, yes. I've written quite a bit of information on that. In fact, Len Horowitz has a lot of that posted on his website.
Yeah, he had the two CDs that came with the book. One of them had the series of tones, and the other one was a composition that was written in the, what is it, six tones instead of seven, or in the music scale?
Well, there we have a diatonal form of music. In our songs, use seven notes in a scale. However, that is the traditional, let's say, what we call diatonic music, written to tertian harmony. However, there are other types of music. For instance, in a complete octave, we divide the octave into 12 parts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the adherence to a particular scale is merely a matter of tradition. It has nothing to do with any particular value in doing that, other than training us to recognize patterns, and it's a type of frequency control, which is why some songs get promoted and others don't.
Well, he kind of, I guess this particular musical scale indicated that it was good for the spirit, so to speak. And of course, he was on the 526 vibration.
528. Yeah, those are called the sacred frequencies or the sacred tones.
Right.
And
that was it. Okay.
Yeah.
Then I had a couple things to say to Ken. I've done quite a bit of looking into essential oils, which goes along with your idea of a herb or an oil emitting a certain frequency that would counteract a particular type of disease and everything. And one really good website's got a lot of information. It's called Heaven Scent, S-C-E-N-T. And that lady is very, very knowledgeable in that. And also, did not Hulda Clark have one of her books, or at least I think you used to be able to find on the internet, something called the Zapper?
Yes. That is another device that she didn't invent it. There have been electrotherapeutic devices in use for all of the 20th century, and there's many patents on them, actually going back to the 19th century. But you're right, what most people call a zapper today, and there's plenty of them available on the internet, are based on Hulda Clark's design. You're absolutely right. She discovers something very significant in applying frequency therapy, and it's this. Zappers are capable of producing different waveforms. Okay, Don mentioned a sine wave. There's another type of waveform called a square wave. If you were to look at a square wave on an oscilloscope, if it's what we call an AC, which means an alternating current wave, there is a positive projection to that wave, and then it comes to what we call the zero reference line, and then the waveform continues into what's called the negative voltage region. Again, you're looking at an oscilloscope now. You're seeing
it's a series of right angles as you're moving, forward.
Right.
I'm familiar.
So anyway,
there's
normally with what we call an AC waveform. If it's sine wave, then it looks like the serpentine S of a sine wave. If it's a square wave, well, it looks like a tall building. It goes up, it's perfectly square, and then it goes down below the zero line. It's perfectly square. Now, if you were to take...
We could add another one, the sawtooth wave, which is
right.
A combination of the...
Right, there's one called the triangular, there's a ramp wave, there's variations. But what I'm getting to is that this is what Hulda Clark found. She found that the square wave produced better therapeutic results than a sine wave. That's the first thing she found. But then she found something that's really, really important. It's at the very heart of a Huldah Clark zapper, it's this. If you were to add a DC voltage on top of an AC square form, now DC voltage is it's the voltage that's produced by a battery. Let's say your square wave waveform goes up 5 volts in the positive region, it comes down to the zero line, and then it goes down 5 volts into the negative
yeah.
region. So you have a wave that's, you know, a voltage that's going from zero up to five, and then it's going from zero to minus 5 volts. If I was to add, let's say, 5 positive volts, DC volts, from a battery to that waveform, I can push that whole waveform into the positive part of positive voltage region of the oscilloscope, so that now instead of a positive north going wave followed by a south going wave, there's just a single rectangular wave going up a total of 10 volts. It comes down to the zero line, and then it travels up, and so you're just getting a series of tall buildings, as it were, square waves, but all of them are resting above the zero line. So all of them are moving in the positive voltage region. It's going from zero up to 10 positive volts back to zero, but it's never going into the negative volt region. This is what you found. When you only have, by the way, this type of waveform is referred to in electronics as a positive offset square wave, okay? Positive offset square wave.
Now, the advantage to music, Ken, mm-hmm. is that you can do the same thing, but you can actually even do more because you can create a multiplicity of waves. The reason why I think she chose the square wave is the more beneficial wave, or the one that would produce a more noticeable result, is because of the fundamental frequency that you're dealing with. If you can cause an interference, for instance, in the pattern, introduce a second sine wave out of phase with the first one, now you can use a phase shifter to produce that result, or you can use a digital delay to produce that result, or a flanger, which will add a triangle wave, and you'll cause that normally mundane wave that doesn't have that push that a square wave has to do the same thing.
Well, that's an interesting area to talk about. In fact, when we get into frequency therapy, we'll talk about various changes you can make to the waveform.
Yeah, what this does is allows you to more specifically deal in the translational aspect of sound and light.
Okay.
Together, that's why I brought that up.
Okay.
Not to negate what you said, but
okay. Let me just finish the point, Gary.
Yeah.
Here's the important point. The reason I explained all that about the positive offset square wave is this: Huldah Clark found in this type of zapping energy is applied to the body, it will kill all pathogens in the body, not just one particular species that the frequency that you're using, no. It will kill all pathogens in the body. On the other hand, if you were to apply a negative going voltage, you stimulate pathogenic growth. This is a very important discovery, so that's why I took the time to explain it. Positive offset square waves are an entirely different ballgame than an AC form square wave, in which you have both a positive and a negative voltage excursion. So if you want to, you know, follow Huldah Clark's recommendation, all her zapping circuits are exclusively positive offset, because this has a tremendous debilitating effect on all pathogens in the body. That's a very important discovery, and she's the first one to make that particular discovery known to the public. Okay, Gary, go ahead.
I had one comment, or I guess justification for the square wave is, it seems to me back in my electrical engineering college days and calculus days, that by taking a fundamental sine wave and adding into it even an odd harmonics of different frequencies and different phases. As you keep adding in these sine waves, you let that number of sine wave functions go to infinity, you will approach a perfect square wave. Which
That's
means,
right.
Yes.
Which means basically that the square wave has all frequencies.
Very good. That's the whole point of using the square wave. I'm sure I'm stealing the words out of Don's mouth. Yes.
Yeah.
Square wave has an infinite number of what are called upper harmonics.
That's what I was getting to. See,
I knew I was stealing your thunder.
Yeah.
So
well,
thank you very much, gentlemen.
I won't take up any more time, but I really enjoyed the discussion. And look into the essential oil thing.
Okay,
I think that would be interesting.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if Rodney called back. I wanted to give him a chance since I didn't take his call. But yeah, that is in essence what I was saying, because I discovered that, yes, you have to adhere in that. Once you establish what zero is, you have to adhere to that constantly, because you're talking about a waveform has a rise and a fall. Otherwise, it just becomes a straight line, and it's not going to move energy in the same way. It's very piercing. You see, doesn't have the mass or the forward motion. This is about moving, you know, change.
Mm-hmm.
And
oh, yes, change, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing it up. As the voltage, I know you know this. This is for the sake of the listeners. As the voltage goes up and down, the current is going up and down.
Mm-hmm.
As the current goes up and down, the magnetic field associated with that current is going up and down. That's extremely important.
Yeah, every cycle of a square wave is an inversion of itself, unless you want to count the upper and the lower portion as a complete cycle.
Yeah, well, with the offset square wave, essentially what you're doing is you're taking the energy that would normally go into the lower excursion, you're putting it all into the positive voltage. So as I mentioned, if you had a 5-volt rise, let's say you had an AC square wave, you had a 5-volt rise in the positive region, you would have a 5-volt, excursion into the negative region. Well, if you push the whole thing into the positive voltage region, now you have a 10-volt square wave going from 0 to 10, staying at 10 for a certain amount of time, then dropping back to 0, to 0.
You know, the next show, if you want, we can actually give a demonstration of this.
That'd be beautiful, Don. That would be wonderful.
You know, we can show the different waves, let the people hear what they sound like.
Yes.
And maybe even play some music.
That would be great. That's fine.
Because it's written already and produced.
Right.
And what's amazing is that I can tell you from the musical standpoint that I have taken 10 physical therapists and sat them in a semicircle so they can all listen to this music. And I didn't say anything about it except to ask them at the conclusion of the piece. I was going to ask them how they felt and what anything. You know, there was no clue given as to what they should feel or what they should anticipate or expect. And for instance, I played a particular piece of music that everyone described feeling cold, which is kind of interesting response, you would say.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said this instrument or this musical piece represents the color blue, and it's to reduce inflammation. In fact, it's to block the aura in the area where inflammation tends to build up because of an energy block. So this energy is pushed by this. Every one of them felt cold. In other words, they were feeling the effect of what the music is supposed to do to the body to reduce the inflammation.
Right. Very good.
Okay. Every single one of them, they said it in a different way. They didn't say, well, it made me cold. It made me cold. Yeah. It made me cold. One person said, I had the feeling I was sitting out on a boat and I was in a fog and I was drifting and it was chilly.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like I wanted to have a blanket wrapped around me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It was producing the result, and they could physiologically and mentally express what that feeling was.
Right.
See? Now, if you take a person that has a severe inflammation, and it doesn't matter if it's because of a muscle strain or a physical injury, where see the pain and the inflammation is a sign that something is wrong and that there's a blockage of energy and there's a buildup of the wrong energy in that area
right.
where they're
thinking. Right.
See?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it would release that pain, or it would allow the energy to move through them, and it takes care of itself.
Right.
It's energy, you see? That's all it does.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand what her device would do applied in that, you know, from that perspective.
Yep.
Although my intuition is telling me that this music is this color. Or these harmonics, or this combination of colors. And eventually, the right amplitude, it's like what Gary so aptly said, is that eventually all the waves form a perfect square wave. All the light frequencies perform perfect white light,
mm-hmm.
see, in the proper combination. But that happens outside the box. Where that occurs, you know, as you well know.
Right.
Well, interesting discussion.
Yeah. I look forward to carrying on with part two the next time we get together, which I think is going to be 2 weeks from tonight. Is that my next, I think that's my next scheduled time.
Yeah.
Unless you just can't help yourself, and you have to invite me back to fill in for somebody next week.
I think the only way that's going to happen next week is if somebody wants you on their back, or I do a show on Saturday.
No, I look forward to continuing this talk. You know, with our next get together. There's a lot of ground to cover, but it's a wonderful thing to. Become exposed to, because what I would like for people to, a lot of people, to experience is the freedom of the anxiety of, oh my God, I don't have a job, or I don't have medical coverage, or I can't keep up this premiums for medical insurance. What am I going to do? The sky's going to fall. And what you need to know is that you can take care of your health yourself. You don't need a doctor. You don't need their expensive equipment, their incredibly over, you know, expensive lab procedures. You don't need any of it.
You can be well and stay well.
Absolutely. And no matter what you encounter, no, I don't care how serious and life-threatening the disease is, if you gain enough information, that's why I'm recommending the books of Huldah Clark. They're gold mines of learning how to effectively treat yourself at home. So there's a lot of books out there that, you know, some of the info is good and some of the info is not so good, but her info is, for my money, top shelf. And she proves everything through the synchrometer testing. That's why I introduced the subject by talking about the synchrometer first. She's not guessing. She proved this empirically, you know, to complete scientific satisfaction. Her theories are solid. Her information is solid. Mm. And she gives it all away to you free. You don't have to go to some university and pay mega thousands of dollars and stress out the instructions over 4 or 5 years. Uh-uh. Just buy her books and start reading them. And you're going to learn far better how to care for your body than, you know, I'm sorry to say, than your allopathic physician might know. And I know that's going to offend a lot of people, but these guys aren't working within nature's rules. They don't know nature's rule books. They have the mechanics rule book, but the body's not a machine, as I mentioned to you last time. Yeah. So once you learn how nature works, and Hulda, you know, is teaching you that, she's really standing on the shoulders of others who came before her, as all great scientists do. But she says that in her book. She gives full credit, you know, to the early work of, for instance, Dr. William Koch, K-O-K-O-C-H. Mm. I mean, it was a fantastic researcher there.
Yeah.
Who was totally, you know, ostracized by the medical establishment. Why? Because he found stuff that actually cured cancer. And they always, you know, box out people who find a, look what they did to Royal Rife. Look what they did to, you know, even Ed McCabe. He's not even a doctor, but because he was getting out the story about ozone, they went after him. They don't let anyone rise to the top in this country who has a cure for anything. And the public needs to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Stop listening to these liars and propagandists of the pharmaceutical industry. They're lying to you left and right about everything.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here. So,
oh, I know.
You know, can I get a witness?
Can I get a witness?
All right, Ken. Ken Adachi, thank you for being on the show. Yes, you will be back again, but it'll be on Wednesday the 23rd.
Okay, yeah.
We decided that we were going to try to squeeze a couple of other people into the schedule next week and actually give you a little time off.
Yeah, that's right. I remember when we made that scheduling, but I think I have a total of 3 more times in December, so I'll be able to get in a lot on this subject over 3 shows.
Yeah, actually, I think it's 2 times.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. I thought it was 3.
Oh, wait, there is a possibility. I think, actually, we have you on the 29th as well. Let's see, 1, 2, no, there's 2 more times.
Okay, all right. Maybe I looked at the calendar too fast then.
You did, and I'm looking at another name and thinking it's you. No, you're okay. On the 29th is when you're on. Tuesday.
Well, we'll definitely expand on this theme, though, over the next 2 shows at least.
Okay, yeah, but the 23rd and the 29th are your next 2 days.
Okay, guys.
Okay, Ken Adachi, the website is educate-yourself.org. Definitely pay it a visit. There's a lot of interesting stuff. Current news is a good place to start. There's always a lot of really interesting articles. And if you're after the truth, that's where you want to go. Ken, have a great week, and I'm sure we'll be talking before the cows come home. So,
okay, thanks. Thanks, Ken.
Folks, you've been listening to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com, and tonight's guest, Ken Adachi. Thanks to Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints, as well as blogtalkradio.com on the internet. And special thanks go out to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. Seth Hendrick on the sound. Our callers, Rodney, sorry we didn't get to you tonight, but maybe we will tomorrow. Definitely welcome to call in tomorrow, I'm sure. My guest tomorrow will be Drew Malone Raines III, former U.S. Marine, and we're going to be talking about all kinds of stuff. Also, we'd like to thank Gary in Arkansas for calling in, and you, the listening audience, for tuning in. I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.